We are talking in general about disorders of abstracting, the problems that center around the inept kinds of abstracting. We talked last time about the language forms involving the transitive verb, to or by, the one-way action verb, as against interaction. I want to try to relate that to a generalized conception of what we mean by a problem. A problem involving a person interacting with other persons. I originally developed this scheme to talk about the problem called stuttering, but it can be used to talk about practically any problem involving the interaction of persons. Along the y-axis, for example, you can have a characteristic or condition. Anything from a degree of fluency or a shade of skin color or something along the dimension from slim to stout, from short to tall. Any kind of a characteristic that for you might constitute the heart of a problem, around which you could have a problem. But you don't have a problem just because you have such a characteristic. You have a problem of the type that I want to talk about only when you and others react to this condition you're talking about, whether it be shades of skin color or degrees of fluency, or nasality of voice, or whatnot. And so along the x-axis, from minus to plus, from little to much, you can represent the reactions, the evaluative reactions of other people to this condition, whatever we specify it to be, of the individual in question whom we represent along the y-axis. You may have this condition from little to much. Now, if that's all that there is to the problem, then, of course, the person who has the problem is the person along the x-axis who reacts. The bald man doesn't have the problem, it's his wife who has some kind of attitude toward the baldness. But so long as he doesn't have any attitude toward it, he doesn't have a problem about the baldness. He may have other problems. He may have a problem, of course, with his wife. But if he does, we represent that along the z-axis. His reaction to the reactions of other people and his reactions to whatever the characteristic is, say baldness. The man who has the baldness has a problem, then, provided he reacts to the way others react to the baldness, or provided he reacts to the baldness independently of what others may think. The problem, in general, is not to be found mainly along the y-axis ever. It isn't what is true of you that matters. It's how you evaluate it and how others evaluate it and how you evaluate the way they evaluate it that matters. That's the ball. No. Thank you for raising the question. The y-axis represents the baldness. He may be just a little bald. He may be completely bald, as a billiard ball, or anywhere in between. Along the x-axis is we represent feelings that others have about the baldness, his wife's attitude toward it, for example. Along the z-axis, we represent his reactions now to his wife's reactions or anybody else's. And also, since it's hard to disentangle them, his reactions to the baldness.
Then with the x-axis, across the y, at whichever point the his degree of baldness was
at
the 50%
level, I think that would. No. The x, what did you ask?
Well, you have a, like a set, you have something set up with the, in this field, with the x-axis across the y, wherever the guy's degree of baldness was.
No, now let me talk about that. This is really Cartesian coordinates, you see. That makes it clear, doesn't it? You can have, let's say you divide each of these into 10 units, so we can talk about it. So you may have baldness to the degree of 8 plus. But he's got a very tolerant wife who reacts hardly at all. And so here's where you locate the problem. A lot of baldness, but not very much reaction to it on the part of other people. Or you might have very, very little baldness, but a very, very sensitive wife. And so then here is where the problem would be located. This is the point to locate the problem. Now, you want to ring this in? You may have very little baldness and a highly sensitive wife and a very insensitive person who has the baldness. And so now then, here's where you locate the problem. You have to think along there. And it'll be right inside, right in here. This part of it, let's get one over in here. He's sort of moderately sensitive to the way his wife reacts to the baldness. He's moderately sensitive to the baldness too, partly because she reacts to it. So now you put this point here on the x-axis, and here on the y-axis, here on the x-axis, and here on the z-axis. So it's off there in the middle, on the z-axis, you see. If you're able to visualize the interiors of blocks, you'll find the point in the middle of the block there. But toward this side, here on the X?
Yes, something that people don't object to at all.
But he objects to it a great deal.
Yeah, he's like a very self-conscious person about something that nobody really knows.
Oh, I suppose you would say that he has a great problem. Well, he has one about which you would say, that isn't it awful that he feels that way? It's too bad because nobody else does. Now, whether this would be a greater problem than another one would be another matter, I suppose, depending on how you wanted to measure the severity of the problem.
Coming from an engineering background, I'm having trouble with my pluses and minuses. Now, the other people's reaction
rejected wall, would it coincide with where the wax crosses?
Oh, it'd be right here. They make no reaction. So it would be zero, depending on how you number this. If you make it 0 to 10, then it would be 0. If you make it minus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it would be minus 5.
Since you went to the ninth scale, let's say a person's wife did have the lightning bolt, and you run the degrees, someone is thinking of, might think it's a tiny little bulb husband, might run it that way.
Yeah, you're going to have to... that isn't what this diagram is designed to represent, I guess. That's no problem. You could do it this way. Why don't you work at it? Because this can be improved. I think this can be improved, but this represents the situation only when there is a problem. In some degree, from very, very slight to much. Now, what you're talking about, favorable reactions, well, then there's no problem, you see. So, but you can have a diagram of whatever you're talking about anyway, but it's not what I'm talking about.
The origin on this diagram, the zero point on any scale, would indicate a moderate degree of whatever quantity.
No, just absence. But it would not indicate a favorable reaction. It's just neutrality, indifference. But no negative reaction. This is a lot of negative reaction, is what I'm trying to say. Maybe I have not made that too clear. A lot of rejection, disapproval on these axes. The farther you get over here, the more the disapproval, the more the discontent, the more the discomfort. Okay? The more the negative. Now maybe the minus and plus confuse you, because the plus means the most negative, and that shouldn't be. This diagram needs to be revised. I can see that. Well, now suppose we go on. We're going to bow down here. This is designed with the need for revision. This is designed to represent interaction patterns of interaction between conditions and evaluations of them, and between evaluations of these conditions and evaluations of those evaluations, reactions interacting with reactions, and interaction and the reactions of the individual himself, the bald man, interacting with the baldness. And almost all human problems, personal sort at least, can be to some degree talked about, formulated in terms of such interactions. And if you were going to investigate any such problem, baldness, stuttering, whatnot, the investigation might very well consist of identifying these variables, or call these factors, identifying them, applying some measurement, how much baldness, how much reaction, how much rejection, how much reaction to the rejection, by attitude scales or by interview methods or by various other procedures, and then identifying the variables which are related to these reactions. Why does the wife react as she does? Why are some individuals so sensitive to the way other persons react to them and others are not sensitive? What are the variables related to each of these factors and to the baldness itself, as far as that goes? And this then would constitute a relatively adequate or comprehensive pattern of research or investigation of a problem, any problem. So if you have a problem, you can fit it into this kind of a frame and think about it, perhaps, a little more effectively than you could otherwise. And proceed then to attack the problem, perhaps, a little more effectively than you could otherwise. Now, there's one very, very important important implication of this way of organizing a problem. And this I represent by the term member of the problem. The bald man, for example, is a member of the problem, but he is not the only member of the problem. His wife is a member of the problem too. There may be neighbors who are members of the problem. Maybe the children in the family are members of the problem. And so on. And this is another way to think about your problem. Who besides you are the members of it? And if you are going to attack the problem, which is the most important member of the problem to be approached in order to do something about the problem? In the case of the bald man, it may not be the bald man. What is the most important thing about the problem to be attacked? In the case of the bald man, the chances are that it isn't the baldness. If you are going to try to solve a problem like this, first you locate the members of the problem. And then you determine as best you can their interactions with one another and the effects of these interactions on the problem. And then you decide which one of these members is the one who appears to be the most important. If you change him or her, you will have the greatest effect on the problem as a whole. In the case of the very young child who is brought to our clinic as a stutterer, the child is the least important member of the problem. You wouldn't do anything with him. Someone who is reacting to something he's doing is the important member of the problem. But if this interaction goes on long enough, then he will begin to react to the responses made by others to what he does when he talks. And so eventually he will become the most important member of the problem. And then you would direct your efforts to deal with the problem to him. Almost always, in the case of problems of the kind I'm talking about, the family, All members of the family tend to be members of the problem. Sometimes all the members of a fraternity are members of the problem. All the neighbors in a block are members of the problem. Sometimes a whole society are members of a problem. in the case of the Negro-white problem today in the United States, we're all members of the problem. And you don't solve that kind of a problem by finding the one most important member of it and doing anything to him. We're all subject to revision so far as we contribute to the problem. Now, the next slide will help us, I hope, to get a little better notion of some of the important elements in the interaction between one person and another. We have all kinds of models these days for talking about ourselves and other things. I have put together a model which consists of a camera and a developer and a projector, which are coupled together so that they work together instantaneously. This is a very high-speed sound and color, the very best kind of camera, a better camera than we've got. And the filters are designed to represent what the filters represented in the first diagram you saw early in the course. Things like moods, educational backgrounds or doctrinal backgrounds, the language that one employs habitually. And so now then, let's put this in terms of let's put it in terms of something I know most about. A mother observing her child and listening to him speak. This is a sound camera as well as optical. Now, the child, what is the child really? Well, about the only way I know to represent any kind of an answer to that that would appear to be sensible is to represent reality here behind a kind of screen. You never can see everything there is to be seen. You never can hear everything there is to be heard. We are limited in our sensory input, our capacity for sensory input. As we have said, the eye can respond only to a very small part of the total light spectrum, etc. So, however you represent what you call observing something, you have to provide for some kind of attenuation, some sort of partial abstracting of what there may be here to observe or to know about. So it is as though the mother were to see and to take a picture of her child through a screen that allows whatever there is that we call the real child to shine through more or less. So she gets a picture of what she can picture. She observes her child to the degree that she can. Now she immediately develops the film. The film runs up into the projector, so she immediately projects the picture, her picture, developed in her nervous system. And now what does she see? Does she see the child really, or does she see the child inside her head? Does she see the child outside her head, or the child inside her head, developed there on the film and projected now as a picture? Now, if you can think of yourself as this kind of a machine, you can begin to get some appreciation of your relationship to your world in terms of projection as it affects perception and what you call knowledge about the world about you. You tend to feed upon your own projection. You tend to see what you expect to see, as we say, because you project what you expect to see. Now, if a person has a prejudice, say against Negroes or Jews or against professors or students or whatever, any kind of a cultural subgroup, categorical group, and now here is a member of the group to be seen by him, what does he see? Well, you can very well summarize, I think, what goes on in a highly prejudiced individual by saying he sees the Negro inside his head. He sees the Jew inside his head, not the one outside. A child with a fear of dogs is always reacting to the dog inside his head and not to the dogs outside. The person who has what we call stage fright is constantly reacting to the audience inside his head and not to the real live listeners outside.
Are you referring this is not filmed before it enters the camera?
No, I said you can't see everything there is to be seen. What did you have in mind? I'm not sure I understand what you're asking.
You can filter even that which you are seeing before it enters the so-called camera.
What do you have in mind? Is this what you have in mind? The screen type of thing? Or something else? I mean to represent the limitations of our ability to observe. No, you can't possibly eliminate this projection. The point is that you can't eliminate projection. It is a bodily function. It's going on constantly. But what you can do is to be aware of it. And when we say that someone is being objective, I suppose what we must mean is that he is taking account of his own projection as best he can. And when you put it that way, it becomes quite obvious, I think, that you can't possibly be completely objective. And so whenever you say you are, I think you are deluding yourself and any others who happen to be naive enough to believe you.
If you were being completely objective, it would be just as though there were no filters.
No filters. Can be seen. So this provides a mechanism for understanding what we mean by prejudice, anxieties, and such concepts. And we're talking about the interaction of persons and persons who react to them, who see them, who observe them, who size them up, evaluate them, who like them or dislike them, who have prejudices against them or not, etc. A mother, for instance, watching her child talk. Whatever the child does, she somehow evaluates. And now she projects what her evaluation. And this now is going to color what she, from there on, hears the child or observes him doing. And if in the process of this evaluation she classifies what he is doing as abnormal, he never after will be able to talk normally to her, no matter what he does, because that is within some kind of limits, because she will be hearing her projection. And her projection is of an abnormality. Once you have decided, try a little experiment, but don't work at it too hard. I'd be a little concerned if you did. Take a look at the person ahead of you. Try very hard now to convince yourself that the person ahead of you has epilepsy. Try very hard. And now just try to be observant of what you're thinking. Whenever you observe that person move or not move or so on. Do the same thing with regard to anything else. It's very hard sometimes to decide at certain hours of the evening whether or not a certain individual has been drinking. Very difficult. If you tell yourself firmly enough that he has been, he can't say anything right. Everything has another meaning. But if it never occurs to you to tell yourself that so-and-so has been drinking, sounds all right. In fact, he may sound good. What this tends to represent, you see, is an identification of levels, of nonverbal levels with verbal. Well, I can't quite hear you.
This small rod that you have in your hand.
No.
And you look at it. Are you filtering out? Are you evaluating the stick? In other words, does everything that you observe, whether it is in movement or whether you're making some type of value judgment towards it, are you filtering that?
Tell me, what am I holding?
Well, I'm talking about projecting it back. I'm talking about, are you actually seeing the stick, or are you actually seeing your image of the stick? Or just, I don't quite understand what this necessarily entails if you're not, for instance, in a baby. If the baby is just there and is not talking or not moving, then I wonder if the same thing applies.
I mean, can you see the baby without projecting?
Can you see the baby without filtering, without making value judgments, or without putting it in your own mind, or however you want to put it? In other words, without interpreting the baby in the way you want to see it. Like, it's cute. We look at it and we can say it's cute. Well, this is evaluating. I'm talking about if you don't try and do anything like that, are we still filtering?
I'm going to hear what you say before I answer.
Oh, there's
I think we should stop and ask ourselves what you mean by valuation, what you mean, what I mean. I use the word very broadly to mean, or I ordinarily do, to mean everything from even the kinds of reactions you would call unconscious to those which are, of which you're highly aware and which represent likes and dislikes and preferences and rejections and so forth. To me, for instance, an amoeba evaluates. An amoeba accepts certain particles for food. He rejects air bubbles. This is evaluation, as I'm using the word. It can be that, primitive. You could, yes, I think you could put a charge on it like that. Go ahead. If you include on your scale indifference, let's talk about the stick. Am I filtering it at all? What do I see? Do I see what is really there? Well, what is really there?
What is really there? What I'm wondering is what do you see? Do you evaluate? In what sense do you filter and evaluate what you see?
Is it putting that stick there or evaluating?
It looks different now. Does that help any?
That's the type of filtering process that you can't be talking about.
I can be talking about that, but I'm not only talking about that. What do you have in mind? You're trying to make some distinction? Yes, I would say yes, if I get what you're asking now.
Even in simple perceptions of anything.
Yes.
Of length and of width and of weight. Anytime we observe anything like this for a simple motion of one thing moving from one place to another, is this all evaluated? Is this all filtered?
Is it all filtered?
Right.
Are you asking, is there nothing... I assume there is a world outside.
Well, but if you filter everything, would you ever know?
If you what?
If you filter everything, would you, in other words, if you do filter everything, how do you know what the essence of this reality that you have me on the screen is?
I represent by that, as far as I know, what we would call consensus. I don't know how else we can determine what is out there, except as you and I and others do the best we can to observe, compare notes, and allow for the differences among our perceptions. And there is a kind of an invariance which is left, and this we can mean then, that if we want to, we can refer to this as the world out there.
Well, the consensus is sort of weak because if most everyone agrees then that we'll say Negro is bad.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, now you're using the word evaluation now in a rather gross sense. I thought you were asking, does something exist?
Right. There is no two schools of thought. One, that there is a stick out there outside that you're looking at it or anything, that we actually do perceive what is out there like it is so long and weighs so much. And the other school of thought is that all we ever have any awareness of at all is our evaluation. And I try to
Well, let me see if I can talk to the point of what you're asking. The stick is rather large to handle. Here's a pencil, you'd say. I'll ask you, what is this? I'll ask you now, help me. What is this?
It is an object which has length, width, I assume weight. As I look at it, color.
Color, as you look at it. Right. Those words were chosen.
The color can change without anything else in the pencil changing.
No. So the color's in your head then. Okay. The modern physicists probably would agree on is that what I'm holding in my hand is some sort of a dancing mass or jazz of electrons, so far as they would be able to talk about it in terms that they would regard as relatively relatively basic. And now we get into words like basic and fundamental that are rather tricky. What they would mean, I suppose, if you were to press them, is that they're trying to get at a description, an account of what I'm holding that would be independent of my observations of it. But of course, no account would be independent, wholly, of the person who formulates the account. Now, when you get all done trying to reduce this to independence from the observer, I think you would probably decide you can't really achieve that. Whatever you say about this, you would end up saying, perhaps, is not this. It's only what you say about it. What I see is not what is here in any complete sense. Now, at some point I come to the necessity, it seems to me, of simply making an assumption, a working assumption, that I am unable to observe everything. I am unable to tell you everything I've observed. I just have to live in midair. I just have to live with this non-allness sort of situation. My relationship to the world around me is such that I am limited. But I personally prefer, and I observe that practically everybody else I know prefers, to operate with a working assumption that it isn't just a dream, it isn't just inside my head, there is something I'm holding here. All I mean to say is something very simple. I cannot wholly describe it. I cannot wholly observe it. So my working assumption is that there is more here than I can see. There is more here than I can describe. And this is what I mean by reality. But if you ask me, what is this reality really? All I can say is, I don't know. And if I were to say more than that, it seems to me I would either have to be naive or somehow deceitful. Did I talk at all to the point of your question? I believe our time is up. See you Monday.
It's a general sermon. It's October 21, 1963.
A particularly effective way, I think, to consider the disorders and the effective functioning of the abstracting process is to examine the forms of the language that we use, the basic patterns into which we put words, so that regardless of what we're talking about, we say whatever the pattern says. We have a basic form of sentence which says, when you supply the words, X is B or not B. For instance, John is a student, Mary is a Welsh or a Frenchwoman, etc. And this can be two nouns that are joined by the relation word is. And is in this form tends to have the value of the equal sign. I wish I had not said that. That would take a couple footnotes. It has the value of the equal sign sometimes. Sometimes it has the value of belongs in, is included in. So no matter what we talk about, we tend to say that two things are alike. We tend to say there are identities in the world. The language says that for us. Or that there are things which belong with other things, and they are the same as those other things, individual by individual. Now, always we use the language with some degree of awareness of what we are doing with it. And the range is, of course, from no degree of awareness to a high degree. When we say that so-and-so is a communist, sometimes when this is said by certain individuals, there is perhaps no awareness that what is being said is that there is an individual who is the same as all other individuals who are to be classified in that way. There are others who would understand that while this is being said, the individual may be different from some of the others who are so classified. That all communists are not alike. But this would require a certain amount of information about communists, and this means usually a certain amount of education, a certain amount of sophistication that most people don't have. If I say that the little Joey is a mentally retarded child, it would take a very sophisticated parent to understand what I have said, except in a rather monolithic way, as though a little joy were the same as all other mentally retarded children. So the language forms, this is perhaps the most common language form we use, and it tends to amount to a kind of built-in error in our language, against which we must be on guard, or otherwise we overstate the similarities, which are ever obvious, of course, and it takes no great eye to see similarities. It takes great awareness to keep from overvaluing them. And partly because the very language we use, the very basic sentence form in this form, tends to exercise our capacity for overgeneralization, tends to encourage overgeneralization, overstatement. The same form can be filled out, can be applied by joining a noun with an adjective. Mary is beautiful. John is stupid. So forth. And the is here has the value of, again, inclusion. And it goes beyond that. It says the sentence, Mary is beautiful, says there is, it is part of a larger sort of a syllogistic pattern which says there are things that are beautiful, and Mary is to be classified with these. That's one of the functions it has, and in that function it is much like the noun joined by a noun kind of pattern in its effects. But it also implies, the is has the value of possession. Mary possesses beauty. There is something in Mary to be called beautiful. There is a quality, a characteristic of the person which we so refer to. And this involves a sort of a displacement of the reference. Because what we are expressing in such a sentence is a judgment. And it is not a descriptive statement about Mary. It is a statement about the way we react to Mary, about the way the speaker reacts to Mary. He attributes to her a quality. He does that. A descriptive statement about Mary in the meantime would be a statement in which the speaker would use words that would refer to the things that we could agree upon, such as height, weight as measured by a scale. We can talk about even things like color, although we recognize that color is a perceptual attribute, but we appear to resemble each other sufficiently that we can use color charts, standard kinds of graduated color differences
for certain fairly exact comparisons. But when we get into words like beautiful, attractive, there is no public sort of reference to which we can relate what we say. And this is a judgment that we're expressing now. This is a statement about ourselves and not about Mary or whoever. And so this is a language form which tends to encourage, to make more likely, the identification of levels of abstracting in the specific form of the mistaking of statements that have self-reference for those which have auto-reference. And this is probably the most common of all of the disorders of abstracting, and the most devastating in its effect, collectively, cumulatively. This is the mechanism, of course, of almost all of the undesirable forms of inhumanity of man to man. The prejudices and permanent hatreds, the dislikes, even food dislikes, tend to be, as far as I am able to understand such matters, perpetuated, developed, and perpetuated by means of this form, by means of the kind of disorder of abstracting which this form encourages and almost makes inevitable. Unless you are highly conscious of abstracting, unless you have a well-developed language for talking about your language, unless you are able to comment about your comments very adroitly, and to make qualifications and to indicate the limitations of what you have said. You can do this. You can learn to do this. And as you do, you become a much more dependable and a much more fair, just sort of person in the way you use language. Can I have the next slide, obviously? You read that all right? There's some other things to be said about one's language. We're trying to learn a richer and richer language for talking about our language. We're trying to develop a meta-language in order to achieve an added degree of freedom, as it were, an added degree of control over what we do. So if we are able to comment about what we say in terms of this sort, we are able to safeguard ourselves and our listeners and our readers in ways that we would not be able to otherwise. Now, the basic observation to be made here is that all language is a substitute for something else. We use language to stand for something else, in place of something else. It is a surrogate, a substitute. One of the most important forms that this general principle takes is to be seen in the fact that we usually are not talking about what the language which we are using at the moment was originally designed to represent. We are usually using a language which was designed to describe some particular thing. Now it's easier to make this clear, I think, if we begin with the observation that each time that anyone has developed a new machine, has invented something, a tool such as the lever or the wheel or the clock or the engine or the telephone or whatever, then the inventor or others who have worked with him and who become the repairman and so forth develop a language for talking about this tool. Almost always then, this language developed for talking about a tool, a specific tool or instrument, equipment, comes to be used for talking about other things and comes to be incorporated into the language in a total sense. Now, and we end up talking about ourselves and other people as though we were talking about engines or clocks or telephones or computers or whatnot. The point is to be aware of this at any given moment when you are doing it. To be aware that when you talk about a strong personality, you're talking about the person using a language originally developed for talking about an engine. You talk about a powerful personality. You're talking about an engine. Well, what is your feeling for the difference between a man and an engine? Or does the difference make no difference to you? Is a man an engine? Would you just as soon have a date with a locomotive? Well, now we can also observe that what has happened as language has been invented and developed, and of course what is rather important, I think, to somehow keep in mind, you find it very easy to remember, is that all language is an invention, man-made. There's nothing like it until it gets invented. Now, language has been developed, as we have mentioned before in the course, to talk about our inner feelings, to talk about the self, to talk about something that is called me, I. If you examine the sentences that you use and that others use, in which we use the word I, or the words me and you, these curious little pronouns, we seem to be talking about some kind of an inner man, there's a little man inside who's named I. And I am just reporting about what I has told me. I wants to go to the movie. There's a little man here who wants to go. And if he wants to go badly enough, there's another I. We seem to talk as though we were somehow schizophrenic. As though if I want to go badly enough, well then I'll have to go. there's nothing I can do about it. I can't help what I want, huh? Now, this all makes more sense if you talk explicitly as though you were talking about two people. I can't help what I like. Now, if you call them Joe and John, it makes more sense. Joe can't help what John likes. But that's the kind of thing you're saying when you say, I can't help what I like, can I? Which I is that? You're using an animistic language, which seems to have been designed for talking about some kind of a spirit, some kind of an inner spirit, the inner man, the little man inside, who is a very whimsical little cuss, and very hard to predict, and because we have created this kind of a verbal inner man, I suppose life is much more, well, in a way, interesting than it would be otherwise, but it also involves much more suffering and disappointment and general kinds of calamity, because we can't control this little man, we say. I can't help what I think, I can't help what I feel, I'm just pretty helpless, you see. This kind of a little verbal inner man kind of runs away with things. There's an animistic language. Talking about oneself as though one had within oneself a little animism. A little animacule, a little thing that's alive, and that wished and hated and liked and got tired and drowsy and excited. And my, he's a most interesting thing to live with. Well, we have such a language, and we use it then to talk about other things. And even when we use it to talk about ourselves, and here we get involved in a rather clear-cut example of how word-locked we are, how language-locked we are. I don't know how to get out of this, to talk about what it would be like to talk about myself without talking about myself. This little man inside. It'd be very difficult. It is very difficult to do this. I can talk about myself quite, as we say, objectively. I can even enhance the effect by using my name, so I can talk about Wendell as though I were someone else talking about me, whatever me means now. We're language locked. I can't really get off here 10 feet and talk about this thing I've been talking about as me very readily. There's tremendous lot here to be aware of, you see. But at least one can be aware of the metaphor. One can be aware of the animistic implication, the animism that is implied. And one can certainly be aware of the use of this language for talking about other things. First, other people, as though they were the same as we. I can talk about you as though you and I both have little men inside, and they're twins. It's So your little man inside you is just like my little man inside me. Now, if I talk that way, I'm going to say certain things no matter what I appear to be saying. I'm going to be implying a kind of, a degree of identity as between us that may not at all be legitimate. And this is another one of the mechanisms for misunderstanding. So often we say, you knew very well what you were doing. Because I would have known had I been you, and you're the same as I am. So you knew too. So you're a heel. It's a language mechanism. You do it with verbal mirrors. But you don't need to do it. You won't do it if you are sufficiently aware of the metaphorical character of the language you're using. If you're aware sufficiently that you are talking as though you were talking about a little animism inside you and another one inside the other person. And that may not be the way things are. And how do you say it? In actuality, whatever that means. Another way to say this, it sounds a little less mystical, is that there may be other ways to talk that would not result in our hating each other. And this would certainly be a game, I think. So long as we are going to use languages that have been designed for specific purposes, so long as we're going to use them for other purposes, we might as well do it in a knowing way. We might as well be creative about it. We might as well be original and develop some new languages. There's nothing to keep you from being inventive in your use of language. You can design new languages. And this is one of the most important things that is being done by the people that we call theoretical scientists. The physicists, for instance, for years used a kind of a model of the solar system. They developed a language for talking about the solar system and the movements of the planets in relation to each other, the Earth in relation to the sun and so forth. And this pretty well provided the language for talking about the atom. It was essentially a solar system language. The modern, more abstract nuclear physicist has a higher degree of freedom linguistically. He is not bound by that model. And this is the big difference, as I understand it. You can do the same thing in trying to understand, trying to talk about other types of phenomena to be explained, such as our own behavior. Have you ever looked at the Freudian language from this point of view? What is he talking about? He is using a language partly that was designed for talking about architectural structures. He's talking about the subconscious as though it were the basement.
and he's talking about the conscious as though it were the upstairs in the daytime or with the lights on. And the thing to do is to bring things up out of the basement onto the first floor where you can see them more clearly. He's talking in part an architectural or a house language, a building language. In part, he's talking a kind of an animistic language involving almost something like warfare. The ego is fighting the id, and the id is fighting the ego, and the ego is fighting the superego. It is a language of forces of this type. You can think of it in the mouths of some speakers of the language, it sounds animistic. In the mouths of others, it sounds as though it were physical, as though the speaker were a physicist by training. And he's talking about vectors, something of this sort. But these are languages. I think the reason that Freud became, partly the reason he became so very famous and seemed to be so very creative was that he did develop language models for talking about human behavior. Now you too can do this. The model we had on the slide at the end of the last meeting was a model developed by using the camera, the developer, and the projector. All right, we have languages developed for talking about these instruments. Now the experiment is, or the exercise is, to see what you can say with this language about a human being that you can't say with any other language. As you get a feeling for models in this sense, you find that you are able to use language with a much greater degree of freedom. You are not so language form locked as you were. You are free to make up new forms, to make up new models, to use languages developed for purposes of some kind that have not been used before to talk about other things. We'll come back to this. One of the most important kinds of model that is being used by some persons today is the statistical model or the population model, the language that has been developed by the statisticians for talking about populations can be used for talking about a person. You can be talked about as though you were a population, as though you were characterized by distributions, standard deviations, modes, correlations, etc. This makes of you a much more complex and, in general, interesting person, and much more understandable person. And if you talk like this, talk this language, talk the language of the population model about a person, you are likely to be much more understanding of him. Because you don't make statements about a population once and for all. It's hard to make a generalization about a population. So you tend not to do it. You say on the average, or 40% of the time, or something, with some trend. And so you can talk about an individual. So you don't condemn him, all or none and now and forever, to one kind of an evaluation that you're going to make of it. Let's have the next slide.
Augie, please.
Language can be talked about as though it were a map. When you do this, now we're talking about languages, we're talking about language. And one of the languages that is very useful, I think, for talking about language is the map language. We have developed a language for talking about maps. Now let's use this language to talk about our ordinary sentences, what we say. So we treat, let's say, a philosophy, a personal philosophy, as though it were a map, which you are going to follow in order to reach happiness. Now the way you would evaluate a map is by asking whether you reach your destination. And by using the map language, you evaluate your philosophy by asking whether you reach happiness. If you don't, what do you do? If you don't reach your destination, what do you do with the map? Well, you revise it. If you don't reach happiness, what would you do with your philosophy? If you were going to treat it as a map, well, you'd obviously change it. Which is a little easier with most maps to know the destination than it is with most philosophers to know the outcome. But so far, this is another way you would evaluate your philosophy. Can you tell where you would go with it? A map is no good if you can't tell where to get with it. Philosophy is no good if it doesn't tell you where to go, what your goals are. Now this seems rather obvious once it's pointed out at all, but it's interesting to look around you and observe, as I think you would observe, the many examples of a kind of behavior which can be described by saying that when there is a discrepancy between the map and the territory, we don't try to change the map. We may not try to change the territory either, but at least we don't revise the map. We may try to change the territory. Some of these examples are pretty obvious. One is what we do about crime and punishment. As a society, we punish crime. First, we have a category of behavior that we call crime. This would take us all winter to look at this carefully enough. But we've got it. We operate with it, usually without looking at it very carefully. And then we treat or we react to this behavior with some form of punishment. Now, we say we do this in order to reduce crime, in order to discourage it, partly to protect people from the people whom we call criminal, again, rather thoughtlessly, I suppose, most of the time. So we have a map here, you see. You can look at the statements we make about crime and what to do about it as though it were a map, how to get from crime to less crime. And so we follow this map. We've been following it for centuries, to more crime. To more crime, we build bigger and bigger penitentiaries. Every time we build a bigger one, we have a celebration. We have an initiation, a banquet, usually, to celebrate the bigger penitentiary. Now we're going to decrease more crime. we're going to decrease crime more. But of course, the bank said we build a bigger penitentiary. This has been this has been going on for hundreds of years. I don't believe this is arguable. The basic facts are arguable. It is one of the very most striking examples I know of our collective behavior in not revising our maps. It's as though it had never occurred to us to evaluate the statements we make about crime and punishment as though they were maps. The moment you make this evaluation, then you begin to try to think of ways in which you might revise the map, in which you might revise the formula, you might revise the principles, you might revise the hypotheses we're acting on. Pretty much the same thing appears to hold true for war and peace. The major hypothesis, as I'm able to read and understand, is that you prevent war and make peace you make for peace by preparing for war. This seems to be the major hypothesis. Now, if you were a congressman, I think you might think a long while before you would act on any other hypothesis. This means you will vote for bigger appropriations and bigger appropriations for what you will call defense. Defense. The assumption is that someone is attacking us. And all we're doing is defending ourselves. But if we can defend ourselves enough, they won't attack. And this will be peace. This is sort of an interesting definition of peace, but it seems to be the one that, as far as I can observe, we operate with. Now, this is a map. These kinds of statements can be regarded as maps of how to get from war to peace, or how not to get to war. Well, the past history of this map is kind of dismal. There have been some attempts to formulate new kinds of hypotheses. Charles Osgood at the University of Illinois, who was here a year or so ago lecturing about his plan for the reciprocal decrease of tension as between groups, has been trying to devise some new verbal maps of how to get from war to peace. The reaction to new maps of this type are kind of apprehensive on the part of most people. It's the same old reaction to the unknown. Fear of the untried. Who's on the panel today? Any reactions yet? Or from anyone else? Argue with that. I don't quite perceive how you are relating yourself to the discussion.
I guess we have gone out somewhere.
I would wonder whether the average citizen, if we may use such a careless term, stops to ask himself what level of confidence he's operating with when he votes for capital punishment, for example. What is the level of confidence that this is going to reduce the crimes for which we now apply this kind of remedy? Do you suppose he wonders much about the level of confidence?
Why are prisons set up to reduce crime? I don't think they are. They're set up to reduce a person. Crime means.
Oh, all right.
I'd say they're doing a good job on that, following that map.
They're doing a good job of reducing, of keeping people from indulging in behavior that is called criminal. Collectively, or the one person who is in the prison?
One person.
Oh. But collectively, does it reduce the number of persons engaging in this kind of behavior at any given moment?
No.
No. Many of the books I've read would seem to indicate they're pretty good schools of crime, graduate schools.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want my boy to go to penitentiary for fear of what he learned. Sympathy for the law enforcement people who are responsible for law enforcement. I would be most reluctant to get too free and easy with some persons who have developed some pretty bad habits. See you Wednesday.